You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Justin Weiss. I'm the director of research for the Center in the U.S. and Europe, which has put together this event. And I'd like to thank TUSIAD and our other private sector contributors who have supported us during the last few years on our work on Turkey. In the past 12 months, Turkey and its foreign policy in particular have been a matter of controversy, whether on Iran, on Israel, on the Armenia question and the non-ratification of the Turkish-Armenian protocol. Less discussed has been the issue of Kurdistan and the Kurdish question, in particular the Kurdish opening launched by the AKP government. And in many ways, Turkey's lingering problem dealing with its Turkish minority remains the country's Achilles heel. The AKP government faces multiple challenges on this front, and the real issue has this issue has a real potential to shape the election of next July. Even more broadly, the future of Turkish democracy and the success of its regional foreign policy may depend on how well Ankara handled the expectations of Turkey's Kurdish community and the expectations created by this opening in particular. To discuss these questions, we have three excellent experts, and I will very briefly introduce them in the order in which they will make their introductory comments. To my left, Dr. Gönül Tol will give us the view from Ankara, I would say, the sort of domestic policy consideration view. She's the director of the Center for Turkish Studies and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. She received her PhD from Florida International University 2 years ago. She has worked for TUSIAD US, and at the Middle East Institute, the focus of her research is Islamist movements in Western Europe and the Middle East and their radicalization processes, immigration, ethnic and religious identity formation, and the institutionalization of political Islam. Second in the order of speakers will be Henry Barkey. He's a visiting scholar at Carnegie, in the Carnegie Middle East Program, and a professor at Lehigh University. He is well-known to many of you. He's an expert on Turkey, the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, and energy. And more importantly, he's one of the foremost experts on the Kurdish question. He travels frequently to the region. Indeed, he was there a month ago. He's getting back in a few days, as I understand. And he will give us the view, let's say, from the region, and also a few domestic considerations. Last to speak is our own Omer Tashbinar, who is a professor in national security strategy at the U.S. National War College and the director of the Turkey project that we have here at Brookings. And we hope to get from him the view from abroad, how this Kurdish question interacts with relations with the EU in particular and the U.S. As well. Omer was previously an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University at SAIS, from where he holds his PhD, and his research focuses on Turkey-EU and Turkey-American relations, European politics, transatlantic relations, and Muslims in Europe. So I've kept these bios very short, but the three of them have had great publications, but I thought we might jump into the issue because we have a lot on our plate, and so I will first give the floor to you, Gönül.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I would like to provide a very brief overview of the Kurdish opening. In the summer of 2009, the PKK's captured leader Abdullah Öcalan made an announcement saying that he had a roadmap for the resolution of the Kurdish question. And in July 2009, the same year, the AKP, the government, announced that the party had their own plan, own program for the resolution of the Kurdish initiative. And I think that was, I think Öcalan's own statements kind of started a momentum within the party. And the Kurdish initiative was a kind of a preemptive attempt. And the Kurdish opening it didn't have any concrete policy changes in it. So it wasn't a concrete roadmap. It was rather a very very vague program intended to trigger a public debate on the Kurdish question and start a reform process. And it did some have specific proposals such as amnesty for the PKK members, public instruction in Turkish, in Kurdish at the university level, the changing of the Turkified local place names in the east, and most importantly, a new and a democratic constitution. And of course, the long-term results of the Kurdish initiative are quite unclear. But I think it did three things. First, the opening triggered an unprecedented debate on all aspects of the Kurdish question, including the issue of secession. And second, it invoked serious opposition, both from the opposition parties, from outside of the government constituency and within the AKP's own ranks. And third, in a few months, both the nationalist opposition and the pro-Kurdish DTP called the opening dead. The nationalist opposition pronounced the opening as a treason, and the pro-Kurdish DTP pronounced it just another attempt to marginalize Kurdish opposition. Certainly, the Kurdish opening is the boldest attempt in the history of the Republic, but it's not the first. There were some abortive attempts, opening attempts in 1990s, in 1991, and in 2005 by the AKP itself. And these attempts, they initiated a debate on the Kurdish question, and they also produced some institutional political changes, such as abolition of the death penalty and legalization of broadcasting in Kurdish. But these attempts did not open discussion to politically sensitive demands such as Kurdish self-rule due to the opposition from the state actors such as the military, media, and opposition parties. And also, these attempts had quite limited impact in terms of ending the conflict with the PKK, meeting the expectation of the Kurdish nationalists, and even with respect to cultural autonomy. So in that sense, if we look at the Kurdish opening launch in 2009, I think it's much more comprehensive, but it has failed. It didn't produce any concrete policy changes. And I think if we have to look at the timing of the opening and the reasons for the opening in order to understand the failure, I think there two groups of factors. First, structural political factors and perceptual factors. And I would like to address the structural, the political factors first. There's external factors and internal factors. And externally, there's been some changes within the region that affected this whole Kurdish opening process. And the first one is closer economic cooperation with Iraq's Kurds. Only a few years ago, Turkey did not even recognize the Kurdish regional government because it would embolden, a recognition would embolden its own Kurdish minority to demand a similar status. But with the intense, the deepening relations with the KRG, there's some kind of economic interdependence between the two actors. And this economic interdependence made KRG's support for a possible separatism unlikely. So it kind of, it eased the tensions and the fear among both the military establishment and the governing party. And second, agreement with U.S., with Iraq, with Iran and Syria, the major actors in the region, against the PKK, kind of weakened and isolated the PKK in the region. And third, and this is Turkey's EU accession process also, it provides an external anchor, but any, it affected the process to some extent, because basically EU encouraged the peaceful resolution. So in that sense, it was it provided an external anchor. And domestically, I think the first and the most important dynamic was the change in civil-military relations starting from 2007. Historically, military has looked at the Kurdish question through a security lens. And that's why many governments and initiatives that wanted to address the issue from a socio-economic and political perspective was objected by the military establishment. But especially after the 2007 EU memorandum, military lost ground and legitimacy, and this just changed the civil-military relations, and this gave this provided increased autonomy of civilian politics from military supervision, and this helped government, I think, increase the government's ability to institute liberal reforms. And also cases like Ergenekon also strengthened AKP's hand. And another factor is AKP is much stronger than any government since the 1980s, just because of the fact that AKP has ruled the country since 2002 in a single party government. So AKP could take political risks. And I think another important factor is AKP's loss of Kurdish vote in local elections in 2009. So there was domestic political competition over Kurdish vote. So launching a Kurdish initiative would help AKP in that sense. So these are the structural factors, external and domestic structural factors. And the opening still did not produce much, and So we have to ask what went wrong. And I think a couple of factors. I think the structural environment, both externally and domestically, was ripe for a solution. But I think at the perceptual level, the society was not ready. The Kurdish opening itself triggered because the AKP wasn't quite prepared for that, and it triggered an opposition from different segments of Turkish society. It just shook Turkey's self-image as a monolithic nation, and the opposition used this quite effectively, especially the CHP and MHP. And AKP just could not handle the process well. And also Kurdish political movements approach, they GTP and it's now called BDP, they distanced themselves from the opening, and at times they opposed it. And they didn't offer any solutions, and they did nothing to ease the tensions that became quite obvious after the opening, and insisted on organizing a public meeting for the PKK members returning from Europe. So all these factors came together, and it was basically a public relations failure on the part of the governing party. And these factors came together and led to the failure of the opening. But it doesn't mean that the Kurdish opening is dead in the long run. But I think it faces important perceptual challenges, and that's why its success, I think, requires skillful public relations and a democratic debate on the issue. Thank you.
Thanks, Gunal. Henry?
Thank you. I'm going to say, let me start with what I will say that my conclusion will be, and then in case I run out of time. And then I will also try to explain why the Kurdish opening now, both from how the Kurds are looking at it and also why some of the structural reasons, and I may go over some of the points that Gunul made, but I will not belabor them. First, let me say that I think the Pandora's box has been opened. So I don't, if you look at what the future portends, I think there's going to have to be movement on the Kurdish question in Turkey one way or the other. And if there isn't, I think then the prospects for stability in Turkey would look very bleak. The main reason I'm saying this is because there's a major transformation that's going on within the Kurdish community in Turkey, which I will elaborate in a minute. But the fact that Pandora's box has been opened doesn't mean that everything from now on is going to go in a nice, smooth way. And clearly, between now and the upcoming elections in June 2011, the Turkish government is not going to engage in any new opening, any new moves. And everybody's expectation is essentially focused on what happens after the elections. So between now and elections, nothing will happen, but after the elections, you will see that pressure is going to start mounting very, very quickly. But that said, this process is a long-term process. It's not something that's going to be resolved over the 1 year, 5 years. I would think it's a 10, 20-year process if one would start immediately after the elections. And it will be a very transformative process as well for Turkey, and the Turkey that will come out of this will be a very different Turkey, I would say. So why do I think Pandora's box has been opened? What are the reasons that's driving all of this? I mean, clearly, when you look at it from the perspective of the governing party, I mean, this is a major problem for them. They need to resolve it. It is an anachronism given what Turkey wants to put, what AKP certainly wants to project internationally and certainly in the region. You cannot be a government or a party that wants to talk about democracy and human rights elsewhere when you have a major problem at home and where you still have very serious potential for inter-ethnic conflict. I don't need to belabor the history of the Kurdish issue in Turkey. I mean, it's been a very difficult, and now we're learning more and more about what has happened over the years, in the 80 years plus of the Turkish Republic, in terms of the treatment of the Kurds. So the AKP needs it for its own foreign policy ambitions. It needs it for its own domestic stability, because this is a party that really believes in stability, not just at home, but also in the region. It has very important commercial and economic interests, and that is a major driving force of its foreign policy. And imagine if the Kurdish problem were to explode in Turkey, what it would do to investor confidence, to commercial issues. And finally, the AKP needs it as a way of, resolve the Kurdish question as a way of completely putting the military in the barracks and essentially locking the door so that the military doesn't find a way to get out, because that's, as you heard from Gönül, the military has used the Kurdish question as a way of introducing itself into politics. Then the other important change is actually the military itself. I mean, the military has realized that this is not a war it can win. After many, many years of fighting in the southeast, and it's not because the PKK has bases in northern Iraq, it's because the PKK is actually quite solidly entrenched, but also because the issue is no longer the PKK. The issue, as I will point out in my fourth point, it's really about politicization of the Kurdish society. So the military itself is now looking for alternative ways of approaching, and in that sense, it was very instrumental. I mean, the military's agreement for the AKP to open up relations with the Kurdistan regional government in northern Iraq, in that sense, was important, because they were looking also for ways of approaching the Kurdish question through northern Iraq, through the Iraqi Kurds. But also in terms of the military has suffered a great deal of loss of prestige about its conduct in the war. I mean, there have been a number of cases in which the military was caught having lied about incidents, and which has made the public for the first time really question the military's conduct, which is something the public had never done. And, you know, in the past there were all kinds of allegations and nobody believed them, no newspaper ever published them. But now the mood is different and people are questioning the military's campaign in the southeast. Clearly, northern Iraq. Northern Iraq, to the great surprise of everybody else, is not turning out to be the beacon that will make all Kurdish communities in the region go for independence. In fact, it has been actually a stabilizing force, again, contrary to expectations. Both Barzani and Talabani have played a very calming role, especially in Turkey. They've been a place where the Turkish Kurds can turn to, ask for advice, and at the same time be a conduit, if you want, to the Turkish government. So in a way, Northern Iraq is emerging as a partner in the process, and in some ways also a driver. It is also a calming influence on Turkish Kurds, because for Turkish Kurds it is, now they know there's a place, and the KRG is now recognized by everybody, including Turkey, which has a consulate in Erbil. So there's a sense in which you're not that traumatized anymore. There is a place called Kurdistan Regional Government. So it is a calming influence. But I think also most importantly is what's happening within the Kurdish community in Turkey. And there, two very important developments. One, actually three. One is that the struggle is moving away from the armed struggle, that the Kurds are no longer looking at the armed struggle as the way to fight the state, as a way to get what they want to get, whether it is cultural rights, it's educational rights, liberalization of the centralized Turkish system. Whatever it is, it is no longer the PKK that's going to do this. So there's a move away from the armed struggle towards politicization. The other is that they have given up on secession. The idea that they will carve out a Kurdistan out of Turkey is now something that the Kurds realize is unrealistic, unrealizable. And it is not just because of the way all the states around in the world and in the region have been arrayed against them, but it is also the realization that today when you look at Turkey, that the Kurds in Turkey live everywhere. They live not just in the southeast, but in Istanbul. And I have never figured out how many Kurds live in Istanbul. I hear all kinds of estimates from 2 to 5 million. Pick a number, 3.5, 4, which makes essentially Istanbul the largest Kurdish city in the world. One. Two, but it's not just Istanbul. There are Kurds when you look in the southern coast, Adana, Mersin. It may be that in Mersin, the Kurds may even be a majority for all we know. We don't have, obviously, statistics. The point is, Kurds are everywhere. So what does it mean to secede when maybe more than half of your population is no longer in the southeast and the east? So that realization has now sunk in. So it has also helped change the way they organize. And thirdly is politicization and organization. What is very interesting is, and this has to do with the question of the armed struggle, what is very interesting, at least to me, is how the Kurds are starting to create political institutions in Turkey. And these political institutions, by the way, are not necessarily anchored in the southeast. They go beyond the southeast, and I'll give you a couple of examples in a minute. But, and ironically, from the perspective of the state, even the AKP and the military, this is far more dangerous to them than the PKK. The PKK you can handle. It's, you know, yes, it's unfortunate. You lose young men in the struggle. But the fact of the matter is, it's a manageable cost. What is unknown now is what this politicization is leading to. And I will use one example for you. Starting in a few years ago, there's a major political case against 1,800 people. It's called the KCK case. It's a huge number of people are now in jail, including some 150-plus mayors and municipal leaders from the southeast, they've all been charged with essentially creating an alternative institution to the Turkish state, mostly in the southeast. It's a 7,500-page indictment which I have. I can't tell you I've read the 7,500 pages. Most of it is actually transcripts of phone calls, most of which are not very interesting. You know, two people are talking. Where are you? I'm at the party headquarters. What are you going to do? Well, we're going to go to someplace. We're getting organized. Okay, call me when you get out. So that's an indictment. I mean, you have these really ludicrous conversations, but all as far as the prosecutor is concerned, even that conversation is proof of some kind of malicious doing. Like most Turkish political cases, this one is like Swiss cheese. It has holes the size of that you can drive a Mack truck. However, when you look at the KCK and what the indictment is saying, what comes through is that this is a serious attempt at creating a parallel institution for the Kurds. But you know, I read the indictment has a constitution of the KCK, and actually I have it here. But when you read this, you realize that this is not a territorially bound attempt. It is for all Kurds, and it is, if you want, an alternative identity, political identity for the Kurds in Turkey, maybe even elsewhere. For Kurds in Germany, but Kurds also in the rest of the Middle East, where you have, I mean, basically they're trying to come up with a structure where you are a citizen of Turkey. They're not talking about leaving the Turkish citizenship, but you also have a citizenship of this thing called the KCK. It is very detailed. It's quite populist, quite lefty. Talks about human rights, women's rights, the ecology, etc. It's actually very progressive. It's kind of fun to read. That said, you realize why all these people have been arrested. Not because they've done anything, they've committed anything dangerous. There's not a single charge, as far as I've read, of when somebody is being accused of having put a bomb or having done something really nefarious. It's all about political organization. And so then you have to ask yourself, do you charge people for organizing politically? Is that a crime? But let's leave that aside for a moment. But in that, when looking at it from the perspective of Ankara, I too would be alarmed by how far this is going and what this huge case with 1,800, and they're all in jail. I mean, so all of these people are being accused of creating this alternative organization. And what is this organization going to do? And it not only has its own constitution, but it has its own courts, its own ways of deciding certain issues. Talking to some activists who told me that, in fact, there is even a shadow government composed of 11 people who make a lot of the decisions in the southeast. So something is happening. Now, the Turkish government may have put a roadblock in front of the KCK for the time being. But this weekend, for example, there's another organization, which is an offshoot of the KCK, which is having its major meetings in Diyarbakir, Saturday, Sunday, where they will talk about, it's called the Democratic Society Confederation. It's an alternative attempt at creating something similar to that. What I'm trying to point out here is that there is enormous amount of political activity. And nobody is making any bones about, they're not putting any distance necessarily between themselves and the PKK, maybe a little bit. But clearly, this is done with the connivance of the PKK, but it is also done independently of the PKK. Because the people who are involved, not everybody is a member of the PKK. So something in that sense is happening, and this is very difficult to stop. right? And this is not going, you know, it's very hard to stop in the sense that it is political activity. And, you know, you meet a lot of these people who are involved now. They all spent time in jail. And they know they're going to go to jail again. But they know it doesn't matter. Somebody else will come and pick up and pick up the pieces and continue the struggle. This is beyond, I mean, this is why I'm saying the Pandora's box is open. There is no turning back. This kind of political activity, and the political activity, by the way, is not just in the Southeast. I mean, they're focusing, all the meetings are in the Southeast, all the others, because that's where they can act more independently. Now, one of the things that has helped, and this is important to understand, why is this happening now? It's happening in part because the world is changing, and as I said, northern Iraq, the military, etc. But it's also because the Kurdish political party, the current one, which is the fifth or seventh incarnation of the original one, controls the municipalities. Even though the municipalities in Turkey don't usually have a lot of money, independent source of money, because everything comes from Ankara, nonetheless, they still have a certain amount of political authority, they still have a certain amount of money is available, and they have political control. So all of the municipalities in the southeast are now controlled by the Kurds. So that gives them the space to do this organization. Right? So think about it from the government's perspective. If this continues like this, and I think I can assure you it's going to continue and it's going to mushroom, what do? Do you now take away the municipalities from the political party? Do you close the political party? It's going to be reopened again. So it creates an enormous amount of dilemmas. Now, but there are other, I mean, this again, even that this political organization is not necessarily a linear development. There are many problems lurking also underneath. The most important is that you have a great deal of frustration, alienation among the youth, the Kurdish youth. What you see in places like Istanbul, Mersin, etc., where during the 1990s, as a result of the counterinsurgency program of the Turkish military, the village destruction, etc., you had a huge population that were forced to leave the southeast. They settled in those cities. When you look, and they settled not in Taksim Square, I can assure you, they settled in the outlying boroughs in very difficult conditions where the bread earner, usually the father, had to probably spend 3 hours in a bus just getting to a place where he may find a day's job. So under very, very difficult circumstances. And I remember visiting those places in the 1990s. But things have moved. Turkey has done well economically. There's more, I mean, conditions are still very difficult, but still somewhat better. But the children of these refugees, who are now 17, 18 years old, are extremely violent, extremely frustrated, and you have constant problems in these townships all over Turkey, which creates a very explosive situation. And the Turkish and the Kurdish political party, the Peace and Democracy Party leaders, have told me, both in the southeast and in Istanbul, they have absolutely no control over that youth. Right? And when they try to put themselves, I mean, there was one very violent incident in the southeast where the party leaders tried to interject themselves. There was a demonstration of women, I think, for prisoners' rights. The police came and suddenly, out of nowhere, these youth emerge, and these BDP leaders try to put themselves in between the police and these youth. And the youth just pelted them with stones and tried to get them out of the way just so they can start a fight with the police. So you're seeing a very dramatic. That's one aspect. The other aspect is, in part because you've had so much Kurdish movement into other parts of Turkey, there is a potential for inter-ethnic violence, something that had been avoided until now in Turkey, right? Because of family ties, etc. It was never a Turk versus Kurd issue in the rest of Turkey. Now it's becoming one. And you hear them. This past summer, there were huge incidents in many places. And very often, it's agents provocateurs who may be starting it. But you can see very well how a local conflict can suddenly become can turn nationwide. So there is that pressure as well. So there is enormous amount of pressure on all these issues. I'll stop.
Henry,
yeah, I'll stop with this. So yes, the Pandora's box has been opened. It's going to be messy, but I don't think it can be closed.
Thanks.
Thank you for the good news, Henri. I'll try to.
It is good news.
Bring some, even perhaps more negative news to this. The main point I'd like to make is that this question, the Kurdish question, greatly matters for Turkey's Western orientation. In this city, we have a tendency to focus sometimes too much, in my opinion, on the Islamization of Turkish foreign policy or Islamization of Turkish domestic politics. And the fear of Turkey parting ways with the West, with the United States, the EU, or relations with Israel is often perceived as this is because Islamists are in power and they have an Islamist foreign policy. I think if we analyze Turkey differently and if we pay more attention to Turkey's nationalist frustrations, we would understand why the Kurdish question, in fact, is much more important to understand, analyze, than potentially the question of Islam. And there are interesting ways the question of Islam overlaps with the question of the Kurdish issue anyway. But the main point I'd like to make is that if you really want to understand why Turkey is often referred to as the most anti-American country, why there is a huge drop in terms of support for European Union, if you really want to understand why the question of Israel in Turkey is being debated with a Kurdish angle now, you really have to pay attention to this nationalist frustration in Turkey. And it's a very complex issue because on the one hand, you have a Turkish foreign policy, as those of you who came here, I think 10 days ago, last week, when Foreign Minister Davutoğlu was here, you can see that there is a sense of confidence in Turkey as well. The sense of, in fact, willingness to solve problems all over the world. Turkey wants to be the mediator between Iran and the United States. Turkey wants to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem, mediates between Syria and Israel. Turkey wants to find a solution to the Afghan-Pakistani problem. Turkey wants to find a solution to the clash of civilizations, because it's the democratic, Muslim, secular, pro-Western country. Yet, when you think about this sense of grandeur, this sense of confidence, all the things that Turkey wants to do, the Kurdish question indeed remains as an anomaly. It is the Achilles heel of Turkey. In many ways, together with the Cyprus problem, which remains unresolved, and the Armenia question, the Kurdish question, I would put these three as Turkey's own problems unrelated to the grandiose narrative discourse that you would hear from the current government in terms of willingness to solve all the problems. Those are Turkey's own problems. And Turkey has, sometimes not because of its own mistakes, but has been overall unable to find solutions to these issues. And we have to pay attention to them because I think it is those issues, and especially the Kurdish question, that will determine the future of Turkish-American relations, in many ways, Turkey-EU relations and Turkish-Israeli relations, too, will have a very strong Kurdish dimension to this. Now, many Turks, in fact, I would argue most Turks, believe that there is a conspiracy in Washington and in Western capitals to create a Kurdish state. That's a constant. That's a given in the Turkish political discourse. So if you really want to understand why from Bush to Obama, anti-Americanism did not diminish in Turkey, despite the fact that Obama came to Turkey, gave a speech in the Turkish parliament, despite the fact that he did not utter the word genocide on the question of Armenia, there is still very strong anti-Americanism in Turkey, it's mainly because Turks still believe that there is a secret American agenda to help the Kurds establish a state. That's something that you cannot take out from the Turkish public discourse or the Turkish psychology, because it's ingrained in the education system. It's ingrained in basically the way we learn about the fall of the Ottoman Empire, that you cannot trust Western powers. Therefore, it's not just an American issue. It's also the West in general, therefore the EU. And these things matter. When Turkey objected to Rasmussen's NATO secretary generalship, when he wanted to become, when he was the candidate, the Danish prime minister for secretary general, the brouhaha was mostly about the cartoons, etc. But in fact, I would argue the big concern in Turkey was the fact that the PKK head offices is in Denmark. The TV was broadcast, the Kurdish TV, I think it was Roj TV, broadcasting from Denmark. And those issues really color the way Turkey looks at Europe. And add to this the fact that Europe is increasingly turning inward because of its economic crisis. Increasingly, there is this backlash against Islam, Islamophobia in Europe. When you add to this to the Kurdish worries that Turkey has, you also realize why there is this sense of frustration with Europe, with Europe in Turkey. It's partly related to the Kurdish problem. And I totally agree with what Gönül and Ari described. The PKK is no longer the big concern in Turkey. In the eyes of the Turkish political leaders, be it military, AKP, any kind of policymaker, the real question now is no longer the PKK, it's Kurdish nationalism. How you deal with the fact that the genie is out of the bottle and the Kurds have now raised expectations. It's a very dangerous stage of affairs, I would argue, because you have a generation in Turkey of Kurds who have as their informative experience only the PKK and the war. And to them, Abdullah Öcalan does not represent a terrorist, but represents their own Atatürk, their own freedom fighter, their own leader who put the Kurdish question on the map. And there's a personality cult around him. There's a huge disconnect in the way the Kurdish youth and Kurdish segments of Turkish society think about Abdullah Öcalan and the nationalist discourse that you have in Turkey. So you have polarized discourses. On the one hand, you have the rise of Turkish nationalism, a country that is becoming increasingly confident, but also nationalistic, partly because of the Kurdish problem. And on the other hand, opposed to that, you have the Kurdish discourse, which is essentially fueled by a sense of confidence as well. Because now Ankara has not only recognized the Kurdish reality, something that was done in the early 90s, but now we're talking about what kind of Turkey? Multiculturalism is on the agenda, cultural rights, but will it end with cultural rights? Do we have to address political rights? Decentralization of Ankara, decision-making. If you decentralize, okay, then fiscal decentralization. Are we going to allow governance to spend more money in the region? What about the question of federation? Can we afford a federation? There are those who argue that a federation should be a solution. Those are the issues that are being debated. And we are at a point where we're beyond cultural rights now. The cultural rights are there. There's still a problem about recognizing the reality that basically the genie is out of the bottle. When a Kurdish mayor in Diyarbakir speaks in Kurdish, this can still become a problem, but that's also part of the polarization. Just to give you another example, when the Flotilla incident happened in May, the next day there was an attack in Mersin coming from the sea. For the first time, the PKK attacked with a boat. And immediately the Turkish media picked up the story, and the Turkish politicians actually catered to that story that, okay, now Israel is helping the PKK. Immediately there was a Kurdish angle to this problem with the Israelis. All it takes is an article in The New Yorker by Sy Hirsch to argue that Mossad is training the Peshmerga for the Turkish belief to emerge that Mossad is there and wants an independent Kurdistan, and the Kurds are there and they will establish this, and it's an Israeli-American Zionist agenda. So relations with the West often refer to this Kurdish question. We pay so much attention to the question of Islam and AKP's anti-Americanism, but we don't pay enough attention to this Kurdish dimension in terms of Turkey's relations with the United States. I would conclude by saying that if you're an American policymaker, you look at this picture and you look at the Turkey that is still very anti-American, and you're frustrated with Turkey because Turkey, in addition to being society that still shows tremendous resentment against the United States, has basically challenged U.S. foreign policy on Iran and has these problems with Israel and in many ways has not delivered on the Armenian ratification. So there's understandable frustration among American policymakers. On the other hand, what is absent in this Turkish-American divergence, Turkish-American problems, is the Kurdish question now. The fact that the United States began cooperating with Turkey since 2007 at the level of actionable intelligence by basically allowing the Turkish military to hit PKK safe havens in northern Iraq has created political space for the Turkish government and even for the Turkish military to rethink the problem to a certain degree. So if I'm an American policymaker, I would say, well, here's something that we did for Turkey. We provided that. And in return, actually, we created a sense of confidence in Turkey on this question, and Turks began to negotiate from a position of strength, not weakness, with Erbil. The good news in this otherwise gloomy panel that we had is that Turkey has now very good relations with Erbil. Why? Partly because Turkey now is able to have a position of strength. And this is related to the tactical victories against the PKK. Yet these tactical victories against the PKK may not translate into a larger strategic victory in terms of solving the Kurdish problem as long as Ankara is unable to address the root causes of the problem, which are essentially identity-related political problems. Socioeconomic modernization will solve it to a certain degree, but it will be really, again, the willingness to address the identity dimension of the problem that will solve the problem. And if I'm an American policymaker, I would urge Turkey to really look at the identity dimension. I would try to help Turkey also to achieve further victories in terms of the demobilization of the PKK that would give further political space to Turkish politicians in order to take the extra step in terms of an amnesty for the PKK, in terms of basically doing certain tangible things that would help. One major reason why the Kurdish opening turned into a failure was the visual impact of PKK militants crossing the border in Habur and being greeted by Kurdish people, treating them as heroes. That visual impact of PKK militants being embraced by the Kurdish people was something that the MHP, the CHP, the nationalist opposition exploited, and that put an end to the Kurdish opening. If you want to understand why Turkey could not take steps further on the Armenia question, yes, you have to look at Azerbaijan, but also you have to understand that the prime minister was unable to pursue two tracks of openings, one Kurdish, one Armenian, while these images of the PKK being greeted as heroes was there. So this is a context where Turkey's public opinion really matters. If there is anti-Americanism in Turkey, if there is major anti-European feelings, Turkey will be unable to really take major steps on these issues because the government will be blamed for catering to an American agenda, for catering to a European agenda. So the West is part of this question, and Turkey's Western orientation greatly depends in whether Turkey will be able to find a solution to the Kurdish problem that addresses this identity dimension. Just one last point I'd like to make about the European Union. Turkish nationalists follow what's going on in Europe. The Turkish government follows what's going on in Europe in the domestic debate vis-à-vis Islam. There's a backlash against multiculturalism in Europe, a very strong backlash against multiculturalism. There's the rise of the xenophobic right in Europe. There's the rise of basically nationalist parties that are anti-immigration. And at the time when Europe itself is engaged in such a backlash against multiculturalism, it becomes very difficult for Turkish liberals to argue for multiculturalism in Turkey itself on the Kurdish front. Because Turkish nationalists are able to say, at the time when the West, the so-called great civilization of the West, is turning so much against multiculturalism, Islam, they're expecting us, Europeans, to Europeans are expecting us to implement a multicultural Turkey where Kurdish is accepted as one of the languages of the Turkish state. They're expecting us to include Kurdish education to school, whereas there's this whole integration, assimilation-oriented model in Europe that is taking place at the expense of multiculturalism. This is a very dangerous situation. It also fuels, I think, an anti-European feeling, and Europe's own problems with its minority, its Muslim minority, may have down the line an impact on the way Turkey looks at the Kurdish problem itself. I'll just stop here and be happy to answer questions.
Thanks, Omer. That was a fascinating overview from all these different angles. And since it's almost three already, I suggest that we take questions right away. We'll take them in batches of three. And I ask you to please introduce yourself before you ask the question. There's a microphone at the end of the room that circulates. And so the floor is yours. Yes, here in the front.
Thank you. Elçinpar Azar from Cumhuriyet. I would like you to comment about the latest news. The PKK leader, Abdullah Öcalan, seems to try to outreach to Gülen movement. How do you see this kind of a cooperation might affect the Kurdish issue? And secondly, could you also comment about the possible WikiLeaks documents, if the allegations until now are true that the U.S. is supporting the PKK somehow? We saw this kind of news stories. If they prove to be true, how do you think the Kurdish initiative will be affected?
Thanks. Okay. Why don't we start with this one, or actually these two questions. Henry, Omer, or Glenn, do you want
to... Who were the questions directed to?
You're the chief.
No. This supposed opening by Öcalan to the Gülen movement, I mean, the truth is, we heard about the news yesterday. I'm not sure. I don't have many details. But let me put it this way. I mean, given the fact that the Gülen movement is a significant force in Turkey today, given the fact that it has a lot of influence, given the fact it is actually quite active in the southeast, I would say that it is a smart move on the part of Öcalan to reach out and to create as many linkages as possible. I mean, what he's trying to do, I guess, is to legitimize himself and the movement. So, to me, it's just logically speaking, it's a smart move. What will come out of it, I don't know. I mean, looking at the reactions today, they were mixed. I mean, some people said this is wonderful, this is great, but some people were a little bit worried that maybe the Gülen movement will try to proselytize. But I think it's too early to tell.
Okay. Maybe Gunnar can...
On that or on the WikiLeaks question?
Well, obviously, I mean, there is this... what made this whole opening a failure was, as Umar and Henri mentioned, this paranoia and the Turks' self-understanding and self-image as a monolithic entity and the suspicion towards the West. So these WikiLeaks documents will just feed into that. And I'm not sure how it's going to affect I don't think it has a huge... it will have a huge impact on Kurdish opening, because those suspicions are still there. And I mean, if you look at, I was just looking at Koç University poll yesterday, anti-Americanism is an anti-EU. It's reached its lowest point. So it's always been there, and so I don't think it will make much difference. I don't know what, Ömer, would you?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a secularist in Turkey who has problems with the AKP, and if you are concerned about Islamization in Turkey, it is obviously a matter of concern that you basically think the U.S. has an agenda to promote moderate Islam in Turkey. So that's one of the narratives that, for the lack of a better term, I would say the Kemalist intelligentsia, intellectuals, are concerned about. And this concern about the U.S. promoting moderate Islam in Turkey, I think, is the twin image of the concern that the U.S. also wants a Kurdish state in Turkey. So if you're a Kemalist, this scenario of the, a rapprochement between the leader of the PKK and the Gulen movement is a nightmare. It's the, you do, these two enemies coming together. But on the other hand, in a conspiratorial way, it also makes sense perfectly, because the conspiracy theorists would say, well, the Gulen movement is a made-in-the-USA movement. They're basically presenting the United States image as a kind of moderate Islam Sufi party against the radicals. So now they are also in the business of talking to the Kurds. So you can see how the Turkish neo-nationalist secularist would portray this as America's plan. Now the Gulenists are in the Kurdish camp as well. They're talking. This is America's plan. So obviously this is part of what I was talking about in terms of how this is very relevant for the image of the West in Turkey. Because the minute the WikiLeaks scenario came out in the Turkish press said, oh, now it will reveal the secret support that the United States gave to PKK, and it will be an embarrassment for U.S. foreign policy. Well, the documents are revealed. There will be more documents, but from what I can see and from what I talk to with U.S. officials, there is no sense of panic, no sense of concern among American diplomats that such a connection will be revealed, because it simply does not exist, except in Turkish imagination. So, but it fuels, again, this Turkish paranoia about America being behind the PKK. And it fuels the American paranoia, the Gulen movement's presence here, Fethullah Gulen's presence in the United States, fuels this paranoia about Islam, too, that there's an American project to Islamize Turkey. And let me conclude by saying that if Turkey's two most important problems, that is Islam, secularism, on the one hand, and Kurdish nationalism versus Turkish nationalism, are debated always with references to what Washington is doing, we should not be surprised that anti-Americanism is not going down in Turkey. As long as Turkey is unable to solve its identity problems vis-à-vis Islam without resorting to conspiracy theories, or vis-à-vis Kurdish question without resorting to conspiracy theories, such questions about WikiLeaks revealing a link with PKK, or questions about the Gulen movement and the PKK talking to each other being basically a project to impose something on Turkey, will continue.
And I just want to say one thing about WikiLeaks. I don't know how that information was suddenly in the press, because, first of all, we haven't seen any of the cables that says, and I can assure you, I mean, I know, having worked in the U.S. government, having followed U.S. government very closely, I can tell you there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that the United States has ever helped the PKK. It would be completely suicidal for the United States government to do something like that, because it would undermine its whole foreign policy with respect to Turkey, which is such a critical ally. I mean, on the contrary. So I don't know how that interpretation came out. We haven't seen a single cable, and I agree with Ahmed. There is not going to be any evidence.
Thanks. Second question, sorry.
Thank you. From Turkish Embassy. Can you also, please,
can you identify yourself?
From Turkish Embassy, my name is Can. About the Kurdish movement itself, we talked about the government up until now, and as a single bloc, the Kurds in Turkey. Can you also please a little bit explain the dynamics within the, there's BDP, you talked about the BDP, the terrorist organization, the youth. But recently, Mayor of Diyarbakir made a statement, and a week later he stepped back from it because there was a huge reaction from a part of the Kurds in Turkey. And can you please also, should we take it as a single bloc, or other voices are there in the Kurdish movement that we are not hearing?
Interesting. Another question? Yes, sir, in the back over there.
My name is Reagan Uptegraf, and I just returned from doing field research in Turkey. But I had two questions. The first to direct to Dr. Barkey. Professor Barkey, you said that the Democratic Society Confederation, it was a different organization than the KJK, but that no Kurdish civil society organization really made much of a move to distance itself from the PKK. And I was wondering if you could expound on the Democratic Society Confederation and whether you thought there was some sort of element of an independent Kurdish civil society in formation, and whether there were groups and what the situation of Kurdish civil society is, because they're obviously pressed between the Turkish government and the PKK in some cases. My second question would be to Dr. Tashpinar. You mentioned that the in terms of this whole Turkish Islamist movement, the pressure towards the pressure to come up with a solution on the PKK, how does that actually how important is that to AKP in terms of actually having the AKP realize cultural rights? Like, if cultural rights have pretty much been accomplished and the next step is political rights, it still seems like there are important steps that the AKP can make in terms of granting cultural rights. For example, Turkey hasn't ratified the Council of Europe's framework for the Convention for National Minorities, nor has it ratified the OSCE's Charter on Regional Languages. Those are both important steps to take in terms of minority and cultural rights that the government doesn't, you know, really seem to prioritize or even put into the discourse.
Thanks. Is there one other question? Okay, let's answer these two or three, actually.
Do you want to start? Yeah. Would you like to?
No, please.
I think as an answer to John's question, I think the Kurdish political movement is far from being monolithic, and there we've seen different actors, different Kurdish actors in the public sphere, and the civil non-governmental organization, and the Kurdish civil society has become, I think, much stronger in the past few years. So there are different Kurdish actors in the arena now, but what brings them together is this, they're quite clear about their identity. I think this is something, I don't know, maybe Henri won't agree with me, but this is something, they weren't as clear in the 1990s. So they are quite clear about the boundaries of their identity, and they're quite clear about their demands. Their demands from Turkish society, their demands from Turkish government, and they're quite vocal about it. So regardless, of, there are different actors, and yet there's something very strong that just unifies them, and that's the Kurdish ethnic identity, I think.
I agree with Gunnar. I mean, sure, there are many voices. Look, time constraints. If you look at the AKP itself, there's a large number of fairly conservative Kurds who are members of the AKP. They are members of parliament, and many of them may be there because there are certain personal benefits to being a member of the ruling party. Look, any society will be very, very diverse. No society can be monolithic. But when it comes to the issue of identity, when you talk to AKP Kurds, just like when you talk to Kurds who belong to Mrs. Ciller's party in the 1990s or to Mesut Yılmaz's party in the 1990s and Erbakan's party, they all have essentially the same identity issues that they articulate. How they decide to deal with it politically is very, very different, right? But when they are in Diyarbakir, for example, members of parliament from AKP who are talking to BDP folks, essentially are speaking the same language, except that when they express themselves at the national stage, it might be different. Actually, most of the time, they keep quiet. Where the pressure comes is within the AKP, and to some extent, AKP leadership also has to respond to the demands of the AKP members of parliament who are of Kurdish origin. They certainly do not share some of the things I talked about in terms of the KCK or DTK, the Democratic Society Confederation. So they're outside of that. But in terms of identity, in terms of putting pressure on the state, they're not that different. And they also know that their own... Remember that they win elections in the Southeast with the barest of minority votes because of the way the Turkish political system, voting electoral system is. So they need some support domestically. They cannot alienate. That said, identity-wise, they're not that different. But I agree with you. There are many, many voices. On the question of the to some extent, it's related on the DTK. The DTK, again, this is a Democratic Society Confederation, is different than the previous attempts in that it is far wider as a political movement. It includes many NGOs that have nothing to do with the PKK. Actually, some of which are hostile to the PKK. So it's an attempt at making the tent much bigger and more inclusive. So in some ways, it's also going to be much more difficult for them to come up to some kind of agreement, some kind of consensus. But it is certainly an attempt at including people who are anti-PKK.
Very briefly on this monolithical Kurdish community question. Of course, the Kurds are not a monolithical bloc. And I think if you're sitting in Ankara, from a purely national security perspective, when you look at the Kurdish community, you divide the Kurds into two groups, those who are basically unassimilated and those who are assimilated. Those who are assimilated arguably are upwardly mobile, relatively better educated, middle class. And if Istanbul is indeed the largest Kurdish city in the world, and if, let's say, 20% of Istanbul is Kurdish, there's a reason why I think Kemalists in Turkey would argue you don't have 20% of the vote in Istanbul not going to the Kurdish Nationalist Party, because a big segment of these Kurds in Istanbul are assimilated. They have jobs. They're educated. Therefore, assimilation works if you have upward mobility. So there's a narrative of the Turkish government which says, forget it, forget the identity dimension, which may lead to thorny questions about multiculturalism, federation, separatism. Let's focus on economic development. Let's focus on modernization. This is a very appealing narrative, and it fuels this kind of perception that we can solve this without getting into the identity dimension. This is one element of the, not having a monolithical bloc within the Kurdish community. Not only the Kurds are not monolithical at the societal level, the PKK is not a monolithical organization. You have PKK in Europe, you have PKK in Kandil, you have PKK in jail, Abdullah Öcalan. And sometimes there are clashing messages. My own analysis is that Abdullah Öcalan still calls the shots, but sometimes there is clash between the European wing and the Kandil wing of the party. Finally, on the question of the European treaties and the cultural dimension, I think there are two issues there. First of all, there are still trepidations and reluctance on the Turkish nationalist establishment to sign treaties on this question, because those would be basically perceived as the West imposing, or Turkey basically abiding by, a Western agenda. So if something needs to be done, we will do it. There's no need to sign anything. That's one attitude. The second one has to do with the fact that there is reluctance to address the cultural dimension. The Kurds basically have moved on. They're no longer dwelling on just the cultural dimension of things. They would be very pleased by having full cultural rights, but what they're really interested in what comes next. What comes next after cultural rights. And that's what also Ankara is interested in, because what we know about nationalism is that it's an intractable process. It's very hard to contain, co-opt nationalism. If once the virus is there, the nationalist virus, it's very hard to say, okay, you will stop short of certain measures. This is why I also sympathize with the Turkish National Security Establishment, the Kemalists, who say, how do we stop this? What is the guarantee that the Kurds will just be okay with just cultural rights or just multiculturalism, just federation? Why not a slippery road towards independence? That's a legitimate question, and I think it's part of the reluctance to acknowledge even the cultural dimension of this. There are still hardliners who would say that we don't need cultural rights, and tying it to questions coming before, if you deny the cultural dimension, you emphasize the socioeconomic dimension. There's no need to improve Kurdish language rights if we can solve this problem with socioeconomic modernization. They will become Turkish. This is the assimilation model. Turkishness works. Kurds will become Turkish. The only thing we have to do is to provide jobs, to provide basically socioeconomic upward mobility.
Precisely, I'd like to follow up on that because I was very interested in your two presentation, and I'll ask perhaps Gunal first to answer this. So basically, you, Henry, you used a Greek metaphor, the Pandora's box, and then you, Omer, you used an Oriental metaphor, let's say, the genie out of the bottle. But you both suggested...
Because I'm an Orientalist.
You both suggested that somehow the situation was out of control, and so this... led me to think that perhaps with the Kurdish opening and all of that, the government had sort of played with fire, and we know how reforms, when they start being implemented, sometimes fuel the opposition rather than quell it or calm it. And so my question would be, how much out of control is the situation, and what do you see in the next 5 or 10 years that could potentially, I would say, derail the normal unfolding or the normal route of Turkish democracy? What are the risks out there in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think on the part of the AKP, it was a big political risk. And the AKP could be able to take that risk because of its, again, as I mentioned during my presentation, it's been in power since 2002 and ruling in a single party government. So that was the big advantage. I think this whole, whenever I read Turkish newspapers and columns, people are quite scared that something horrible is going to happen to the Turkish state after this whole Kurdish opening. But I really think that this is a very healthy discussion. Yes, the society is quite polarized. But on the other hand, we are now talking about Kurdish separatism or a federal maybe system. And these are, we have denied even their existence for such a long time. So I think the level of discussion that we're having right now on the Kurdish issue is quite healthy, and the initial response wasn't a surprise. Let's say polarization, societal polarization. But at the end, I think we are going to find a new modus vivendi in Turkey at the societal level and at this institutional level too, because there are some studies conducted among Kurds living in Turkey, and the poll asked what they really wanted. Did they want their to have their own state? And whenever I talk to Kurdish intellectuals, I ask the same question. So they basically say, of course, it's our dream. But at the same time, we are quite aware that this is not realistic. There is Turkey on the one hand, there is Syria, Iraq, and Iran, and there is a landlocked Kurdish state. And it has oil, but yet it doesn't have the infrastructure. So this is not realistic. And I think Kurds know that. And that's why I'm quite hopeful that a new modus vivendi will be reached within Turkey.
Henry, Omer, a new modus vivendi or a situation out of control?
No, first of all, we also have to emphasize the Kurdish opening of AKP failed because AKP mismanaged it. It mismanaged it in the sense that it tried to consult people, but it did not try to consult and bring into the process
the people who are most involved in this, i.e. the Kurds. For example, when you look at the return of those famous PKK guys, the main, at the time it was DTP, not BDP, the main Kurdish political party had not been informed. They found out essentially 2 days before or 3 days before the event. So at no point did they bring in, they could have managed much better the process. Okay, mistakes take place. I mean, it's not, I think there was a little bit of, there was a great deal of hubris on the part of the government that they can control everything, that they knew what they were doing. But the prime minister now has essentially put a target, a huge target, and that is, he said after the elections in June, the most important priority is to change the constitution. Right? And clearly, any solution to the Kurdish problem has to come through the constitution and the change in the constitution. So I would say that if the constitutional process is well managed, and by that I mean not just on the Kurdish issue, but on a whole variety of things. I mean, the Turkish constitution is a straitjacket. The Turkish constitution essentially protects the state from the individual. It doesn't do anything for the individual. So all that conception of the Turkish constitution has to change. In the process, if the AKP manages this process well by including everybody, not just Kurds, but the opposition, all kinds of NGOs, etc., and makes it a genuine a constitution that is a product of the people of Turkey rather than a political party, I think that, that there's... I don't see why this problem cannot be solved.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I agree. I mean, Turkey squandered the big opportunity in 2007 after the 2007 July elections. AKP had a huge majority, and instead of pushing for a genuinely democratic, liberal, inclusive constitution, there were basically problems, and the country, all of a sudden, they were trapped to a certain degree to this headscarf business, and in a matter of a year, they were facing a constitutional case, and their own survival was at stake. So hopefully this time, and all the indicators is that we are heading to yet another big victory for AKP in the next elections. This time, hopefully, they will learn the lessons of 2007 and act accordingly. I'm afraid that there is a tendency here, linking it to Turkish foreign policy, to talk to Erbil at the expense of Turkey's own Kurds, to basically say, look, we have an excellent relation with Erbil, our relations on the Kurdish question are improving, we have basically improved our partnership with northern Iraq, yet the same prime minister, the same leadership is reluctant to talk to Turkey's own Kurdish nationalist party on the grounds that it doesn't distance itself from the PKK. So, there's a vicious cycle in Turkey. All the debate in Turkey turns about why the BDP or the DTP before it does not condemn terrorism. It's like trying to ask a Sinn Féin to condemn IRA. I mean, this is the political wing of the movement, so it's very difficult for them to clearly condemn terrorism, but the situation is very tense. I think despite all the good momentum and positive potential, if there is a bomb in Istanbul that kills a high amount of people and it's linked to somehow a Kurdish group, there is potential for violence in Istanbul, in Mersin, in Adana, in Izmir. There is potential for violence because now you have this Kurdish youth and Turkish youth, so something like that could easily unravel. And so there is potential for both momentum, the kind of discussion of the constitution, but also a major polarization, which would obviously put any kind of democratization issue on the halt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the result of the KCK trial is going to have a huge impact on the future of the democratic opening as well. AKP is giving mixed signals, and I guess that just reflects the balance of power, the domestic balance of power. On the one hand, you're talking about giving more rights to Kurds, and on the other, you're basically arresting legitimate Kurdish policymakers and intellectuals. So I think the result of the trial is going to be important.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Maybe one, and now there are questions. Sir, and then you're here in the third row, and then I'll ask the panelists to conclude.
First of all, thank you for a fascinating panel. I, for one, have learned a tremendous amount. What I'd like to do is build on the last round of comments that were made and ask you to move from the analytical to the advisory. If you were advising a Turkish government of whatever composition after the June 11 elections about how they might most constructively reframe the challenge of addressing the Kurdish question, both in terms of domestic political, a new civilian constitution, an outreach to Turkey's, a more effective outreach and inclusion of Turkish Kurdish population, but also building on Umar's comments about Erbil and the no problems with the neighbor regional policy. Is there a possible constructive play off of that in a way that would, for example, bring the East and the Southeast back into the crossroads, the regional economic, trade, commercial development that everyone thinks is in the offing but hasn't quite gotten there yet? And that's not too confused.
And sir, I'm sorry, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Michael Lemon from the Muniri South Asia Center.
Thanks. And last question here.
Thank you. It's Aylin Yazan from CNN Turk. My question will be about Mr. Öcalan's words on Gülen movement again. As his lawyers asserted, he said that if PKK and Gülen movement build a mutual understanding of each other and stand in solidarity, many of Turkey's problems can be resolved. We now know that the issue has so many dimensions, but how do you see the chance of this possible cooperation, which will also exclude a big part of Turkish society, I mean people who are not Kurdish and who are not member of Gülen movement, in terms of finding a solution to the to this question?
Okay, thanks. So I suggest we go in perhaps in reverse orders to answer the questions and offer concluding remarks. Omer, would you like to start?
Yeah, on Michael's questions about from diagnosis to prescription, what would we say? I guess not to repeat the mistakes of 2007 and be inclusive for a new constitution. Start early after the electoral victory, if it happens. Build on the momentum of strength and spend your political capital on this issue. Prioritize this issue. There will be a limited time span. I mean, there will be pressure for the Armenia protocols as well. There will be pressure on the Kurdish opening. So it will have to be very wisely formulated in the sense that the constitutional debate, I think, can happen parallel to what needs to happen on the Armenian ratification front as well. But there will be a limited time span, I would say 6 to 8 months for the government to do to pursue these openings in the kind of honeymoon period and try to reach out to CHP, reach out to MHP. There's a new leadership with the CHP, which is more promising than Baykal. It needs to be tested. In what ways Kılıçdaroğlu will be willing to really discuss openings on the constitutional question. So from the speech at the night of the election to the next steps, the name of the game will be inclusivity, willingness to engage, instead of basically saying we're the victors and arrogance. On the question of socioeconomic development and how the zero problem would create economic momentum, Already, I think there is some economic momentum in the region. The reason why AKP is the number one or number two party is because they have created jobs, because they have built roads, because they have built schools. So the question is, how do you go beyond this? How do you also create, in addition to this kind of socioeconomic agenda, or the narrative of we are all Muslims, why we can't get along, to emphasize Islam? You emphasize basically diversity and embrace the diversity of the region and speak about Turkishness not as an ethnic category but as a civic citizenship model. And those are the issues, I think, more than the economic question. It's how you build on the economic momentum which is there in the region, especially because of trade with northern Iraq. Finally, on the question on Gulen and PKK again, I think we should refrain from seeing this as a kind of zero-sum game. If Gulen and the PKK talks, that means the secularists and the Turkish nationalists are out. No, I mean, we should, I think, instead of dwelling on this issue as a big breakthrough or something that could change the dynamics, we should see this as a kind of tactical move and not something that will really change the fundamentals of the problem. Both the Kurdish question and the Gulen community have a narrative of victimization. The Gulen movement's narrative of victimization is essentially about Islam and discrimination against pious Muslims in Turkey. The Kurds' narrative of discrimination is about discrimination on an ethnic level. There is nothing more normal than people who feel discriminated against to basically create a sense of empathy. Instead of seeing this as, oh, the enemy is uniting, we should just try to understand why, what kind of mistakes we're doing that basically is pushing this kind of situation. There should be, we should be, I think, cool-headed and analytical instead of seeing the kind of sensationalism of this issue, but maybe it's too much to ask from media.
Thanks. Henry, a brief word of conclusion?
Well, in terms of what to do, what advice, I'm not in the business of advising the Turkish government, but I would say that, look, the constitution is the most important issue. I mean, I would think that, imagine a victory speech, assuming he wins a victory. I mean, at the moment, it looks that way, but politics is a different, is a weird animal. But let's assume he won, and if the first message that comes out of his mouth the night of the victory is about the Constitution, it will frame the debate, just like when he did after his first victory in 2002, when he came out and said that Turkey was, the first objective was European Union. And that kind of framed, until 2005, essentially, the Turkish government behavior, mentality, etc. Now, the Constitution, I said earlier, it has to be an inclusive constitution. It cannot be a constitution that is created by one political party or political party plus its supporters. It has to be a genuinely inclusive constitution, process that creates a liberal constitution. And it should be a constitution that is not going to be changed every 5 or 10 years. I mean, the problem in Turkey is that they come up with constitutions which are inflexible, have a lot of problems, have unchanging elements to it, but at the same time, people feel the need that constantly there has to be changed. No, you need a constitution that, for better or for worse, is going to last you for a long time. But constitution writing is a long process, and it's not going to be something that will be done in 3 months after the elections. It may take years to write, to come up with a genuine constitution. So what you need to do between now and then, you also need to buy yourself some social peace. And one of the best ways, I mean, what the Kurds really want, and that's not going to happen before the next elections, is to, you know, Turkey has this 10% threshold in for parliamentary representation, and they would like to see that pushed down to 7 or 6% so that they can get more of their MPs into parliament. That would do enormous amount of goodwill on the Kurdish question, since, Mike, you asked about the Kurdish question. I don't think they're going to do that. Okay, so if they're not going to do that, there are other things they can do. And I would say there are a lot of people who are now in jail for political crimes,
who have not done anything violent but are spending 20-30 years in jail just on and on very, very shoddy evidence. And there are people who, I'll give you, Abdullah Öcalan got two trials. Why? Because he first was convicted, and the court of European Court of Human Rights overturned the conviction because he was found guilty by a state security court which had a military judge. So he got another. He got convicted again. Okay, so we. But there are a lot of people who never got a second chance and are still in prison. You can give them a second chance, release a lot of people. You have people who went to jail when they were 17 and are 30 years later or 25 years later are still in jail. Given and the misinterpretation of what happened in Habur when those guys came back, it wasn't a victory celebration. It was, for the Kurds in the southeast, the beginning of a process where they thought the kids would be coming home. People don't understand, I think, about the Kurdish Kurds in the southeast. There are a lot of people who have their kids, their cousins, their relatives in jail, or their relatives up in the mountain, and there are more kids going up to the mountains every day. So they want an end to that process. So if you can create the atmosphere by which people can come back, and you release some of the people in jail who are for political crimes. And also, as Gnu said, deal with the KGK or KCK trial. That will buy you enormous amount of time to do the constitution. And that's what I would advise.
Thanks. Gnu?
And I think the AKP, the government definitely has to bring the BDP to the table. A closure of the DTP, I think, hindered the process immensely, and because it basically took moderate actors, political actors such as Ahmet Türk and Aysel Altuğluk out of the picture. And the government has to realize that PKK is not only a terrorist organization. It's become a political actor. And in... I know it's quite challenging to do this, but PKK somehow has to be engaged, and the civil society organizations, the government I think has to work with the civil society organizations. So framing the issue is going to be quite difficult, considering the nationalist, how strong nationalism is in Turkey, and especially, I mean, the AKP has a very very strong nationalist base itself. So it's going to be a very difficult task. But I think, as Henri and Omar just mentioned, there is no going back. And I think from now on, the government has to take the necessary steps to build on that process.
Thanks very much. Please join me in thanking very much the three panelists. I think that was a terrific discussion.